Thanks, Joe. As King Henry VIII told his fourth wife, I'll be brief. Actually, she was brief because he had her executed, which says something, by the way, about the changing role of women in society. Today, my wife has Lorena Bobbitt's picture on the refrigerator, and I have to watch everything I do. I will focus my remarks on the economic dimensions of higher education that draw heavily on an essay I recently wrote from the National Review. In a typical year, in the last generation, the cost of attending college has risen about 3%. This is West Virginia PowerPoint, by the way. 3% faster than the inflation rate. Costs have risen even faster than family incomes. As Americans get richer, they can afford to buy almost more of almost anything. Yet college is a conspicuous exception. It is no wonder that, despite huge increases in federal financial assistance, the proportion of lower income Americans in the college population has actually declined over the past 30 years. And the rise in the proportion of adults with college degrees has slowed, and among young people, many other nations have proportionally more college graduates than America. It is no accident that the two sectors facing the greatest consumer price increases over the past generation are healthcare and higher education. In both sectors, governmental involvement largely neuters the ability of a market to efficiently allocate resources. In both areas, third parties, neither consumers or producers, pay many of the bills. When that happens, the consumer is not very sensitive to price, leading to wasteful uses of resources. For these reasons and others cited by scholars like Charles Murray, a good argument can be made that we are over-invested, or at least mal-invested, in higher education. Now, there are at least two ways that this over-investment is manifested, it seems. First, properly conceived, higher education requires relatively high levels of cognitive skills and a high level of interest and determination on the part of students to master relatively complex and nuanced ideas. Even with grade inflation and a seriously watered-down curriculum, 45% of today's college students fail to graduate within 6 years. 6 years. Our dinner speaker tonight has written eloquently about all of this, as did two generations ago, for that matter, Harvard President James Bryant Conant. Now, second, a very large proportion of jobs being created in America today do not require higher levels of education, and certainly not a college degree. We're entering the era of college-educated pizza deliverers and the tree removal individual with a master's degree. I had a tree removed recently with a guy with a master's degree working with a guy with an eighth grade education. The eighth grade education guy did a better job of cutting the tree down than the guy with a master's. Now, one out of eight mail carriers in America has at least a bachelor's degree. Is that required by the changing imperatives of delivering the mail? The vocational imperatives of college education proclaimed by the rent-seeking members of the higher education establishment are greatly exaggerated. Now, returning to the issue of inefficiency, over 90% of American higher education is nonprofit in nature. Nonprofit institutions, some of which are great, like the Heartland Institute, which is having its 25th anniversary, I had to say that. Joe was going to cream me in the comment period afterwards if I didn't put that plug in. That was part of the deal. Nonprofit institutions lack incentives to be efficient. The officers of for-profit Hewlett-Packard or Campbell Soup or McDonald's work hard to do two things: increase revenues and reduce costs. The gap between revenues and costs, profits, is the major bottom line that determines executive compensation, stockholder wealth, employee bonuses, and so on. There is no well-defined bottom line in most of higher education. Is Wabash College having a good year in 2009? Who knows? Now, looking at the revenue side first, for-profit corporations compete to win new customers and despair when they lose market share. Contrast this with many universities. Lacking a bottom line, private observers like U.S. News and World Report, Forbes magazine, and others try to create one. I do the rankings for Forbes. They create one by ranking colleges. In the dominant U.S. News rankings, improvement is advanced by turning customers away, reducing the percentage of applicants who are accepted. By contrast, at McDonald's, the acceptance rate is 100%. Everyone with adequate cash can buy the goods. So at many of the best-known universities, supply tends to be rigid and unresponsive to changes in demand. With third parties paying part of all of the bills via government and private scholarships and subsidized loans and public institutional subsidies, schools can often raise their fees without dire financial or academic consequences. They particularly sock it to the more efficient, more affluent customers whose financial conditions the colleges uniquely in American consumer life, they know them in exquisite detail thanks to the FAFSA financial disclosure form required of all applicants for financial aid. If you go in to buy a car, they don't ask you to fill out a financial form giving your assets and liabilities before they tell you the price. They do with colleges and universities. Now, on the cost or supply side, perverse incentives often increase costs. It's even often ambiguous who makes the decision or who owns the school. The university trustees, the top administrators, the faculty, the students, governors, legislators, the alumni and major donors. Joe Bass here, and I'm serious here, can speak to this as one who serves as a trustee of a college. Powerful tenured faculty and their deans usually control curriculum and can make life miserable for presidents. I know, I've done it. The presidents to buy peace, give the faculty nice salaries and benefits and parking, low and falling teaching loads, and maintain outmoded low demand academic programs that should be axed to increase efficiency. Students are given fancy country club-like facilities in which to live and play, and increasingly non-rigorous curriculum. It's the average GPA, grade point average in the U.S., has gone from about 2.5 to about 3.2 over the last 50 years. So students can lead a hedonistic lifestyle of parties, booze, and sex. The alumni's favorite collegiate entertainments, typically involving sweaty young men and women throwing balls, are heavily subsidized at many schools. Everyone part of the shared governance of universities is paid off to keep them happy. And the cost, and this all costs buckets of money. Decision making is made by committees, typically in a costly and non-innovative fashion. I used to be chair of a department at my university. I talked the dean out of letting me hire one more professor, so I now had 17 people to do what 16 did before. Same output, more inputs, productivity fell. I was rewarded because my faculty helped determine my salary. They evaluated me. Now, what other occupation is it where the employees decide who the employer is going to be? Crazy. It is the second peculiar institution of America. Now, measuring academic productivity is difficult since universities do little to measure what their students are learning, and also research is equally difficult to evaluate under almost any reasonable assumption. What Joe was talking about with K through 12 holds in higher ed, productivity certainly is probably lower than it was 40 years ago, and certainly not higher. In what other profession, other than teaching, possibly excepting prostitution, has there been absolutely no productivity advance in the 2,400 years since Socrates taught the youth of Athens? Over the past 30 years or so, the enrollment-adjusted non-instructional professional staff of universities has roughly doubled. My university has a sustainability coordinator, a recycling coordinator, umpteen diversity and public relations specialists, almost none of whom existed when I began teaching. How much do they enhance the quality of the instructional or research program? Zero. Or arguably less than zero, inasmuch as so-called diversity efforts are typically an attempt to make academic hiring and even contracting decisions on the basis something other than merit and achievement. As for research, much of it is of trivial refinements of insignificant issues for a nearly non-existent audience. Jeff Sandifer of the Acton School of Business estimates each academic journal article costs on average $50,000 to produce. Now, assuming the average article is read by, say, 200 readers, the costs are $250 per reader. Mark Bauerlein of Emory University notes that there are over 22,000 articles that have appeared on Shakespeare's writing since 1985. Is there that much more new, insightful thoughts about the bard who died 394 years ago? Have not diminishing returns set in for much academic research? More generally, statistical analysis done by me and others at my little research center I run called the Center for College Affordability and Productivity suggests that the correlation between state government appropriations for higher education and economic growth is actually negative, which makes sense when you consider that we take resources from a highly productive, for-profit private sector and reallocate them to a relatively inefficient sector, universities that do not use technology to advance both outcomes and productivity. As the late Milton Friedman said to me a few years before he died, perhaps he was wrong in his early writings, and instead of subsidizing higher education, we should tax it. And for Milton Friedman to want to tax anything was some, as Dwight and I have written on this, actually, haven't we, Dwight? This cataloging of the economic sins of universities is far from complete. Accreditation organizations have raised barriers to entry without notably improving academic quality. My friend Dick back here can tell you a whole story about that, probably will, which has served to restrain innovative private entrepreneurs. The for-profit higher education sector is lower cost, and perhaps ironically, disproportionately serves the low-income first-generation university students that have largely been abandoned by the flagship state universities. Indeed, its growth is one of the most positive modern developments. The rapidly increasing institutional financial support for intercollegiate athletics is a scandal that needs addressing. More importantly, the refusal of universities to measure their educational outcomes and be fully transparent in their financial dealings makes it difficult to assess academic and financial performance. And the huge dropout rates that I mentioned, the 45% dropout rates, is a huge problem. And the average time to get a PhD now approaches 8 years. The solutions? Moderate solutions would include reduce or eliminate rather than increase the federal student loan programs that have enhanced demand and raised prices, give money directly to students, not institutions, and limit aid to truly needy students who perform well. Cut off third-party support of students and institutions after, say, 4 years of undergraduate study. Substitute a system of good consumer information to protect consumers for most of the current certification process that stifles competition. encourage greater ease of transfers between institutions, favor lower-cost community colleges that are not as afflicted with some of the ailments that I've just described. Develop non-schooling ways of certifying vocational competence, involving tests similar to the CPA exam. But more radically, a very strong case can be made that higher education is truly a private good, that the positive spillover effects of universities are vastly overrated and arguably non-existent, and that government should get out of higher education altogether. If more spending on universities lowers economic growth, then maybe higher education has a negative externality associated with it, sort of like pollution. We should look at, higher education the same way as we look at polluters. The higher earnings of college graduates exist less because of what the kids learn in college than from intrinsic advantages college students have over others. They are innately brighter, harder working, and more responsible. Now, the strategy that I have outlined is roughly the opposite of that followed by policymakers in Washington and most of our states. Whether common sense can ultimately trump the rent-seeking political lobbying of the higher education establishment remains to be seen, but alas, I'm not overly optimistic. Thank you very much.